Just kidding. I offered him the opportunity to come give the pre-concert lecture, but he's busy managing the stage. Good evening, everybody. How are you? It is such a pleasure to have you with us. I know many of you, but for those of you who I may not have met, my name is Laura Weber, and I'm the music director and the conductor of your very own community orchestra, the Livermore Amador Symphony Orchestra. This is our second concert of our four-concert season, and its thematic title seems like something we really need right now. Inspirational journeys, an inspiration to take us away from what feels like the weight and trouble of the world. We talked about this a little at our dress rehearsal on Thursday, where somehow making art, whatever your art is, feels more necessary, more relieving, and more powerful now than perhaps in a long time. And we need to attend our arts and listen to our music and share our music and our words and our crafts together, to not just to divert ourselves, but to put what we're feeling into something beautiful. And that is a unifying theme through all the compositions on tonight's program, starting with a truly inspired composer, Jennifer Higdon. Jennifer, I feel like I know her, but I've never met her. She's a little older than I am. She was born in Brooklyn, I think in 1962. And when she was a little girl, she moved to the South. She moved to Georgia, and then later on moved to Tennessee, in a little town called Seymour, Tennessee, in East Tennessee. And that's where she was raised. She characterizes her parents as two hippies who lived in East Tennessee. And her dad is a commercial artist who did visual arts and painting and graphic and graphic design, and listened to all kinds of music, but she had absolutely no background in classical music, quote unquote, classical music. She had rarely heard an orchestra, if ever, was not a child prodigy in any way, shape, or form. She was bred on the Beatles and bluegrass, not Beethoven. And somewhere around the age of 15 or so, I think, she became interested in the flute. So her mom bought her a flute that she thinks may have cost something on the order of a whopping $70, $75. And she got a beginning band book, probably the very same one that you teach from, Kathy, or something similar. This is how you finger a B flat, this is how you finger an A, you know. And she taught herself to play, and it took off. A flute teacher came to East Tennessee, and she took a lesson, and the next thing you know, she went off to some sort of summer music camp, probably not unlike the Silver Lake Band Camp that many people attend here in this area, or, you know, a summer camp that was in Bowling Green State University, and ended up going to school there and majoring in flute performance, having only begun to play in her mid-teenage years. While she was there, her flute teacher had a master class with another flutist who came in who happened to also be a composer, and instead of preparing a solo piece from the standard flute repertory for this master class, her teacher said, "Well, this is a composer, so why don't you write something," to Jennifer Higdon. Now, Jennifer Higdon is now a Pulitzer Prize-winning composer. She won the Pulitzer for a violin concerto that she wrote at the request of Hilary Hahn. She's just finished her first opera. She is one of the most frequently performed composers whose works have been written in the last 25 years worldwide. She makes her living entirely on commission. There's probably like maybe 20 composers in the world who make their living entirely on commission. If you're going to be a composer when you grow up, you know you're going to have like five or six other jobs at the same time. So when her flute teacher, when she was an undergraduate at Bowling Green State University, said, "Why don't you write a flute piece?" She said, "How do you do that?" She didn't know what an interval was. She didn't know that da-da was a third, and that da-da-da was a major triad, and that if you took that middle note and lowered it a half step, da-da-da, that's a minor triad. She didn't know the symphonies of Beethoven. And look what happened. So when she was at Bowling Green, this is why I feel like I know her, She met Robert Spano, who is now the music director of the Atlanta Symphony. And he had just gotten his first job as a conductor there, and he's also a composer. And she had begun this little flute piece she wrote. She characterizes it as it was kind of an exciting flute part, but a one-note ostinato in the piano, like a repeating pattern of one or two notes, because she really didn't know how to compose. She then opened up her imagination and just tried things and ended up composing pieces and showing them to Bob. And when Bob saw her voice on paper and realized the talent and the inspiration that she had, he wouldn't let her out of his studio. He locked the door and said, "You can't leave until you promise me that you're going to go study composition, preferably at the Curtis Institute of Music." And her response, of course, was, "But I don't know anything. I don't know anything. I don't know the theory, and I don't know the history, and it doesn't matter." So her sort of backdoor accidental entry into the world of contemporary classical symphonic and chamber and solo and all kinds of other genres is, in a way now, looking back, quite liberating. She never knew the rules, and so she never had to worry about breaking them. And when she did learn the rules, she felt terribly behind. And I know that I felt this way sometimes in my own work, and I think Bob probably, I studied with Bob Spano at Oberlin a few years, maybe like 5 years later. And at the time, he would encourage me to stop thinking of myself as less capable because I was not a child prodigy on an instrument from the age of 4 or something. That I could learn what I didn't know. That you have talent, and experience isn't required for that talent to shine. And you can learn what you don't know. And I think the Jennifer he was referring to was her, as a point of reference for me in starting my serious study of music. So Jennifer ends up entering the Curtis Institute of Music, where everyone around her did start playing an instrument somewhere around the age of 3 or 4. She had to take all the remedial history, theory, ear training, you name it, just to catch up on the basics. And she pushed and persevered through her own, obviously, you know, looking at herself in comparison to others, her own fear of her lack of experience, and was so compelled to communicate. And this is what her belief is about composition. The composition composers, their job is to organize sound so that musicians can communicate something to you. I mean, I know that sounds really basic, but rather than an intellectual exercise or a creative personal exercise that has this very specific pattern, for her it is, I want to reach you. I want to reach you. And you don't need a PhD to be able to feel something when you hear my music. So she's an incredible talent. And a brave human being. To this day, when she's introduced on stage as the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer, Jennifer Higdon, she goes, and it makes, she says it makes her sweat when she hears it. So tonight's piece, when she was coming through Curtis and people were beginning to understand how unique her voice was and how specifically special her talent was, she got a number of commissions from major musical institutions all at once. She was writing and writing and writing with big deadlines. And in the middle of this, her very close sibling, her brother, Andrew Blue Higdon, died quickly from a very virulent form of cancer. And it was, you know, devastating. He played the clarinet, she played the flute. And you'll read more about this in your program notes, I know, but she was pressed on all these deadlines at the same time that she had to be with her family in grief, this terrible loss, and she had to continue to compose. She could not miss these deadlines. And so this piece, Blue Cathedral, is in a way a grief process for her. And you'll hear the very specific references in it to her relationship with her brother, most specifically in the beginning of this very calm opening, only percussion at the very beginning, playing very softly as if from a distance. You'll note that it's called Blue Cathedral. She's imagining that the listener is inside a glass cathedral in the sky, the color blue all around through the transparent walls. And that glass quality, this kind of shimmering sound, she captures in the percussion at the beginning. And then there's a kind of a very soft bed of string sound underneath this beautiful duet for her and her brother, essentially. The flute, who comes first because she was the older sibling, and then followed by the clarinet. This is what the close to the beginning of the piece sounds like. She envisions us moving through this cathedral, and one of the characteristics of her writing is an incredible ability to pace the progression of rhythm in the music, that without really noticing, suddenly you're a little faster, and then you're a little faster, and then you're a little faster, and suddenly we're soaring upwards with momentum, a sense of upward rising and freeing flight to the sky. And I won't play the peak of the piece. You should experience that in live performance. But this is part of that buildup of energy and momentum as we follow these two voices upward. Lined up like a keyboard and played with mallets. There's a lot of percussion in this piece. And I don't know, Bob, if you're out here, we owe such a debt of gratitude to Pleasanton Band. Thank you for letting us use your instruments. There you are, Bob. Bob Williams. Thank you, our hero. So one of the things you need to know about Jennifer's works, she likes to write much more interesting and complex music for instruments that normally only play bup, bup, right, for the tuba, or the bass trombone. And she likes to write really active tuba parts and low brass parts, and she told a story of when this piece was premiered and recorded, well, when it was recorded by the London Philharmonic at some point. She walked in to watch the recording session, and the tuba player stood up and went, So, we are keeping them very busy tonight. In any case, what I find so moving about this piece is she was not really conscious of what she was going through as she was writing. She was meeting a deadline. And instead, what happened was subconsciously, she titled the piece Blue Cathedral, Imagining a Cathedral, having no idea that her brother's most recent apartment had been on Cathedral Street in Baltimore. I lived like around the corner from him. I didn't know that, in Baltimore. He died at the age of 33. At the end of the piece, there's 33 little, they're not played by the chimes, but there's strokes in the piano that sound like distant chimes. 33 of them. She ended up accidentally composing a series of notes that end up numerically spelling out his birth date, 731. It's just extraordinary what happens to people when they're liberating their feelings through inspired creative action. So this is an extraordinary talent, and her genuine her willingness to not allow rules and boundaries to hold her in is something I think that she shares with Grieg. Edvard Grieg, the voice of Norway, who closes our program tonight. He was, in some cases, ridiculed for how simple his music sounded, how easy it was sometimes to play, that it didn't have that kind of complex structure and contrapuntal density of Brahms or even of Tchaikovsky or Liszt. He knew all those composers, and he was certainly very well aware of their techniques, but what inspired him was the folk music of his own nation, his own city, his own people, and his melodic gift is unparalleled, really, in many ways, and it comes straight out of, he doesn't necessarily directly quote actual folk songs themselves in these symphonic dances, but all of his melodic writing and the dance tunes are all taken from traditional folk dances and folk songs. This made him such a kindred spirit to his citizens, his fellow Norwegians, that people would and their families would run into him on the street in Bergen and whistle his own songs back to him. He was a kind of a Pied Piper for Norway, and really his music embodies that humanistic, democratic, Norwegian approach to this day. So his symphonic dances were one of the few pieces that really approach a true symphony in their scope. He didn't really write a complete symphony that is performed today, but this comes pretty close. It's a four-movement work. Each one is a set of dances, and each dance movement has three parts. They're all in ABA form. So you'll hear a melody that's developed for a little while, and then there's a contrasting dance that's developed, and then the A melody comes back at the end. So maybe we could listen to, in the first dance, the very first thing you'll hear, it's called a Halling dance, and I watched some guy do it on YouTube. He gets down on his hands and knees and flips his body backwards and forwards, and somebody's holding a hat out on a pole, and he has to kick it off with his feet from the ground. So that's what the energy behind this dance is describing. And then, as you can imagine, the contrasting theme is totally different. It's in a minor key, it's in G minor, and it starts as a solo melody in the oboe, much slower, much more reflective character, and it takes quite a dark emotional turn. Thank you. like a slow movement in a symphony. So the first theme you hear is quite a bit more andante, a relaxed tempo. It's an absolutely beautiful solo for the oboe, lots of oboe solos in this piece. And you could probably dream up lyrics to this melody in a second and a half. It's so intuitive and natural to sing. And this is where you get to hear also Grieg's love of sort of that one perfectly timed magical triangle stroke. Here's the second movement. Jaunting onto the stage unexpectedly, a completely different character, a total change of pace, and it's also, well, listen to it. Dances. It starts very softly, you're not really sure what's going on, and then he does a classic Griegian kind of thing with his use of dynamics. He suppresses the sound of the orchestra for as long as he can, letting the tension build up until, as you can imagine, the roof comes off the building, we hope. Well, maybe not totally off. Now, I'm looking at my, you're probably wondering why this is here. It's vodka. No. I forgot all about this. I have it sitting right in front of me, and I forgot to explain. And I still can't decide if I'm going to tell the whole audience about this or not, because I know that Jennifer Higdon wanted her music to speak for itself without knowing what was going on in her head, and without necessarily being told ahead of time what was happening, so you could just have that experience and not be prepared. prepared for it. So I don't know if I'll tell everybody else tonight, but what she does at the end, she builds up so much energy in the middle of Bloomington, of the Blue Cathedral, that she needs a way to bring the energy down. And as she does this, she introduces two unique sounds in the orchestra. There's a lot of percussion, but you'll hear, instead of the horns playing the sustained sound, they play. Going on in open fifths. There's a lot of open fifths, da, 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 which is very medieval church-like music. We're in a cathedral, after all. In the horns and in the trombones, instead of them playing their instruments, they're playing these glasses. And then when she was composing the work, there are two stories. Not really sure which one is correct, but we do know that she made an accidental discovery. My favorite story is that the accidental discovery was made by her cat. While she was composing, you know, the cat's always walking on the music. And somebody had given her these wonderful therapeutic balls. They're Chinese reflex balls, and you roll them around in your hand, and it does something wonderful for you. And it makes a lovely, soothing sound. And as she was composing, I don't want to drop it on the floor, but the cat knocked one of these things. Hit the deck and made that sound, and that was it. That was the sound she was looking for. And the next thing you know, when you rent this piece to play it, the music comes in a giant box, and so do sets of these bells. So you'll see, you might not see, some of the violins and some of the, I don't remember if the cellos have them, throughout the orchestra, the clarinets do, and it creates this wonderful atmosphere at the end of the piece that. What do you think? Should I tell everyone?
Yeah.
I should? Okay. I will. You get all the credit. And of course, I don't want to neglect, I think I'm running over time. I don't want to neglect Beethoven and Sibelius, two of the most unique concerti they ever wrote. I mean, Eunice Lee is an absolutely poetic pianist at the age of, I don't even want to say how young she is. And she's bringing such beauty to Beethoven. You'll hear his inspiration is the octave, bum, 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 and the scale. Da-da-da-da-da-dum. He just finds different ways of filling up that space and makes an entire concerto movement out of it. I'd love to play the whole concerto for you with her. And before that, on the first half, Felix Chen will be out here playing the Sibelius Violin Concerto first movement, which is also an extremely unique piece. The cadenzas are embedded in the structure of the piece. Instead of being sort of a separate thing, the cadenza is like the development section, the middle of the piece. And it starts in this very unique way. There's a very soft minor chord being played in the violins. And instead of that going on for a while before the solo comes in, he comes in almost right away, but he comes in not on the downbeat, but on the weaker second beat. And he comes in on what almost sounds like the wrong note, a G. It's a D minor chord, and he comes in on a G, which is not in D minor. And it's just the most beautiful thing that is then echoed by the clarinet. And the next thing you know, we're off in this dark swirl of sound that Sibelius is so good at creating. So I know you're going to enjoy those talented young musicians, and I'm very grateful that you're here tonight. And I'm thirsty. You'll never know what's in here. Thank you so much.